So don't sit down. Hands like this. Cross them over, knee and shoulder. Right? Like this. That's it. You're kind of getting there. Boy, do you guys drive cars? I hope not. Believe it or not, that actually gets the brain circulating. It gets the blood through right in the... Actually, no, I confess. It was my secret attempt to get you to be Pentecostal. All right, now, before you sit down, the only people who can sit down are those who don't have a smartphone. If you don't have a smartphone, you may sit down. And it can be an Apple or it doesn't matter, but if you don't have a smartphone, you can sit down. If you do, if you don't have one, sit down. If you do, hold it up. Let's see. Right? Now, turn the off button off. Thank you. All right, we're good. So, thank you. I'm actually going to put my timer on so I can ignore it like I did last night. All right, well, thank you. I know it's a busy morning. I'm ready for my second cup of coffee. When it comes to coffee, I'm a hobbit. You know, first breakfast, second breakfast. So what I want to do is do a bit of revision from last night, which may help you. You often hear that it was the Christianization of Europe that led to the victory of the forces of superstition and oppression and darkness, all that kind of stuff, over the wonders and glories of ancient Rome and Greece. Ever hear that narrative? And it wasn't until the Renaissance and the Age of Reason and the Enlightenment that we were able at last to throw this stuff off and to enter the wonderful sunlit uplands of reason and ancient classical antiquity. That it was the recovery of Athens that led to the modern world. And if you believe that, I have a bridge I'd like to sell you. It is a load of old cobblers, and Brits will understand exactly what that means. Right? I want to suggest to you, in fact, that it's exactly the opposite that's true. And critical to getting that, you'll hear me say this several times, whatever else it is, Christianity is not a religion. Don't ever make that mistake. No one in the ancient world saw it as a religion. In fact, religion's a modern world. No Roman thought they were practicing religion in the sense that we think of it. That's a modern conceit. And one of the reasons Christianity got into trouble is because it's actually a grammar of life. Wherever they go, you read the book of Acts, they keep bumping up against the fabric of the ancient world. And the ancients don't quite get it. But the people of Thessalonica, kind of, they pick up and they express this frustration. The guys who've turned the world upside down are coming. And you understand, turning the world upside down is not just going to a temple and taking off Zeus or Demeter and putting up Yahweh. That's not what it was about. It was actually turning their entire world upside down. Now, they didn't really get that, but there are implications of the gospel that really went for this. So the Greeks had a word for demonstration. We'll talk about that today. They loved logical demonstration, right? And Paul refused to play that game. He said, I came in a demonstration of spirit and power based on experience. That just drove the Greek philosophers nuts, just as it does some theologians. You ever heard people say you don't build your theology on your experience? If that's what you believed, you wouldn't become a Christian. The whole narrative of Jerusalem, Israel, and the early church is based on experience. Right? Yeah, I'm going to see that. And that's why, forgive me, I just do feel more at home with Pentecostals. Because we have a preference for experience, and that's the mark of Jerusalem. And it's the mark of the modern world. Right? So I'll have a few more things to say about that. I'm building up slowly for a word of exhortation for you on Sunday morning. Slowly getting ready for this so it doesn't all come as one big one. But you better get ready, right? I love you guys, and I love you too much to leave you as you are. So watch out Sunday morning, right? And that's, you know, that's God too, right? So actually, I want to suggest that the key thing that Christianity does, it's actually about knowing the world. How you know people, how you know yourself. It's a grammar of life, to use Kevin Rowe's expression. And you might recall last night, I talked about my experience in China. I talked about Tom Holland, the ancient historian who now says my values are unashamedly Christian. Okay. I could have added Michael B. Foster. You all know him, I'm sure. Not. He wrote a very famous article in the 1933-34 journal called Mind, and we all read that journal, I'm sure. Sorry, mate. Okay. But his argument was it was actually the Christian doctrine of creation that for the first time enabled the world to push back against rationalism. It's actually the Christian doctrine of creation that then gave birth to modern science. Francis Bacon understood that. 17th century guy, Francis Bacon, you ever heard of him? He's the guy who said you have to get rid of Aristotle, otherwise you'll never learn about how the world is. So, you know, myself, along with a few others, are utterly convinced that the modern world, with all of its incredible advances in learning, growth and freedom, is the direct product of Jerusalem's victory over antiquity. The gospel was designed to overturn the classical world because the classical world was a horrible place of unchanging oppression and cruelty in spite of all these wonderful intellectual philosophical endeavours. Actually, in some ways, I want to say even because of it. Plato and Aristotle justified slavery, justified elitism. They just wanted to keep the world as it was. And amazingly, the gospel conquered antiquity, whether the form of Egypt that we spoke about last night or Mesopotamia, and what we're going to talk about today, conquering Athens. All right. So let's have a little bit of a quiz. This is a revision moment, those of you who wanted it. And quizzes, always good, aren't they, for revision? And I'll come down and I'll tap you on the shoulder and you can start in front of everyone. And would that be good? No? Okay. So we won't. So, we talked about how the ancients, this is before the Greeks saw or before Hellenism. Hellenism is to do with Alexander, so the period before that. How did they see the world and the gods? Anyone? Yep.
Personalities.
Yeah, exactly, right? The world was the gods. It's very hard for us to get used to that because we're so used to seeing trees as just stuff. But not for them. There were spirits in them, their things, right? There's gold in them, thou hills, and there's spirits in them, thou trees, kind of thing. Okay? That was, by the way, Egyptian accent, in case you hadn't noticed. Right? So any time you have power, there's agency behind that. Now, they knew about the Creator, but did the Creator really matter to them? No, because he wasn't actually active in the world. The gods you were concerned about were the gods that actually were currently engaged in this living creation as they saw it. So what really mattered was the sun god or the storm god, Baal. He's really important because if he's not happy, you don't get to eat. You need the rain, right? And one of the things that gets a bit grubby about that is that they would actually see that, you know, some of these storm gods as, pardon me, copulating with the earth. So guess what their religion takes on the shape of? So you have female god priestesses, obviously, and male priests, and they copulate, kind of a peep show for the gods to get the gods a bit excited, and then hopefully the god would then mate with Mother Earth and you get your grain. Right? Just imagine living in a world where you thought that was true, where that was a fundamental, unquestioned truth. What would that do to your society? How would you see people? My goodness. And the world itself, who was the world made for? Well, not for humans. It was all about the gods. They were the world. It was for them, right? And the same thing for temples. Temples were about the gods. Cities were about the gods. What was the one thing you had to do if you wanted any chance at life? You had to keep the gods happy, right, at all costs. And so temples were not for worship, right? What we're doing here is not what went on in temples. Temples were houses of the gods where you took care of the deities and their images. You believed the god actually indwelt the image, so you'd feed them, you'd clothe them, you have the dancing girls, you get them to visit one another, they'd stand and have a long conversation with each other, right? Just, and as long as you kept them happy. Right? And they did that seriously, and people lived their lives under that. We laugh, and that's okay, but we only laugh because of the gospel. These were serious matters in the ancient world. Now, interestingly, these gods, even though they were gods, were basically just all too human. I mean, read Homer's accounts of the gods. They have all these human foibles. Homer's gods are basically Greeks on steroids, just very large Greeks. Right? It's all about power. They got angry with one another. They raped. Right? They'd murder, they'd kill, they'd do all this kind of stuff. They'd get angry in ways that you couldn't really predict. So that's what the gods tended to be like. On the other hand, human beings, even semi-divine kings, what was our job? We were basically viewed as the gods' slaves. We worked the fields to keep them happy, fed them, but that's all we were, actually. And what does that mean then? That means that justice becomes what? Justice is sustaining the status quo. That's essentially justice. Imagine living in a world where justice means that, you know, you're a working class guy maybe, or your boss, you know, he's the one that sits at the top of the pile driving around his latest, whatever it is, Tesla or something or other. And justice means that, first of all, you couldn't take him to court because that would disturb the status quo. And when a court decision came up, you always went with maintaining the status quo. Imagine what that would look like. Imagine living in cultures where that was the fundamental basis of existence. Right? It had nothing to do with whether you've been badly done by. It was all about, are we maintaining the status quo? Because that's what the gods have spoken into being. And think about that. We've got to get these things into our heads, folks, because that's what that world was like. And thank God, and I mean that literally, we don't have to live in that world anymore. Right? We live in a society where even... Now, I know we're falling into some stuff because we're losing sight of who God is. But ostensibly, little people should be able to take big people to court. Right? Ostensibly, that should happen. And that's the gift of the gospel, right? And the prophets. So that's justice. Now, the problem is in all of this, the gods didn't actually tell you what they really wanted. Remember we talked about that? We're Christians. We have the Jewish scriptures, Israel's Bible. So we're used to God telling us what he wants. I've told you, O man, what is good, that you love justice, do mercy, walk humbly. Really clear stuff. They didn't have that in the ancient world. They have to try and work out what the gods want, and you could be doing everything like you've always done it, and suddenly your wife dies in childbirth. And all you know is that the gods are angry with you, and you have no idea why. You imagine the desperation? Have you ever seen children who've grown up in abusive households? Ever seen that? And all you have to do is just raise your hand quickly and watch them cringe. Ever seen that kind of go on? Work with people like that? Yeah? Imagine living in a culture that's what the gods were like. It's that constant, you're just not sure what's going to happen. Imagine living in that world. Now, that's not North America. People stand upright. There's a confidence. Where does that come from? That comes from the gospel. An article was written in, the London Times, maybe it was now, 2.5 years ago, by a world-renowned atheist who said, Africa needs Christianity. And that can sound a bit racist, not meant to. His point was, when he goes to Africa, every African he meets who stands up and looks people in the eye, they've been touched by the gospel. Right? It's profound. It's a wonderful thing. And, you know, I'm actually surprised at how... For my black brothers and sisters, just the racism that they experience, and not just from white people. I mean, let's be honest, Asians too, right? I've seen that happen. And even people in the Indian subcontinent, so in Vancouver, have quite a few Sikh people. They're incredibly racist towards black people. Right? It's just outrageous. Right? We should not tolerate that. Everyone is made in God's image. Everyone. So, their world, this stuff happens. Imagine living under all of that. Now, what we didn't talk about was what stands over against it. And over against this is Moses and the prophets. And this is just astonishing stuff. So, given that's what everyone else in the world thinks, are you feeling hot in here? I'm feeling pretty hot. You want a door open?
Right.
Are you? Turn off the heat. Yeah, because, you know, I'll keep you warm anyway. Just... If you're cold, come down the front. I'll actually lift my arms too. And then all your suffering will be over very quickly. But for Moses and the prophets, the Creator God was actually still involved. And he cared deeply and intently about this world. He sustained it by his very word. Right? And not only caring for creation, he cared especially for humans. This is a God who is good to all and has compassion on all that he has made. Any idea how radical that is in the ancient world? As a historian, forget being Christian or religious, as a historian, how do you explain this? When you've got an environment where everyone believes what we've just talked about, where in the world does the notion come from that the Creator actually really does care? He's not distant, he is involved, and he's good and has compassion on all that he is. Where does that come from? That's a huge problem in the history of ideas, just as an academic. Try and explain that. And that's not all you have to explain. For this Creator, the world is not divine in any aspect at all. We talked about the sun and the moon, right? They're nothing. They're not gods. They're not deities. They don't control you. You don't need to fear them. Imagine the liberation of that, right? You can walk through a forest and you're no longer worried about the spirits in the trees. No longer an issue. That's gone. You don't have to worry about some god blindsiding you without you having any idea what's going on. That's all gone. Imagine the freedom and liberty involved in this. Imagine. Now, I don't want to get into trouble here, but I probably will. Not from you necessarily. But I have taken some tours to Israel, and usually we go through Egypt first up. It's important to do that. And for me, I can't help but notice the difference when I move from an Islamic world to the Jewish world, and just the difference in the way people present themselves. Right? There's that incredible sense of dignity, right, and individual significance that you meet when you get to Israel that you just don't have in Egypt. You just don't. I'm not here to attack any. I'm just saying that's what I notice, and I think it comes out of this story. So you have to understand, as I mentioned last night, we think it's kind of quaint, and we have museums about it these days, and we look at these wonderful cultural artifacts of times past where people thought there were spirits in the trees and all this kind of stuff. Right? Yeah, we can afford to do that because we don't actually live in that world. But Moses and the prophets, they were just dead on the, you know, just on this kind of stuff. Dead set against it. They're going to kill it. They just had to root this stuff out. Get out of human society if humans were truly to know what God's world was like. And creation, this didn't mean you could treat it as trash because, as you know, what is creation? What's the biblical metaphor for creation? God's palace temple. It's a holy place. Right, so you treat it with respect. It's not God, you don't worship it. But you wouldn't dream of dumping toxic waste in your lounge room. Don't do it to God's creation. Revelation tells you what will happen. God will destroy those who destroy the earth. Oh, right? Now, we're not talking about some kind of Beatrix Potter view of the world. No, we need to engage with it. You know, we need the timber, that's important, but we don't rape and pillage. And can I say, it's to our everlasting shame that it took pagan non-Christians to remind us that that's what the Bible said. And I think the reason we needed reminding is because very early on in the life of the church, we got infected with Hellenistic thinking. And it all became about going to heaven, all this stuff is just going to burn up. Folks, that's a thoroughly pagan idea, and we need to stop. And you're known for being Bible people. You should know this. Read your Bible, for crying out loud, right? Creation groans waiting for his redemption. Okay, I need to stop that little sermon there, but my goodness. You understand, this is an evangelism issue. I have friends in the environmental movement who wouldn't darken the door of a church, right? Wouldn't go near it because of the way they see Christians talking about the created world. Right? Now, we don't have to become what they become ideologically, but they're a rebuke to us. Right? My Jesus is being ignored by them because I'm not treating God's creation as he tells me I ought to. Right? And it's time we stopped for the sake of Jesus and the gospel. Right? It doesn't mean you can't have technology. We just need to be thoughtful and careful about what we do. Okay? So as I say to some people in Vancouver, guys, if you have a problem about the size of your anatomy, you don't fix it by getting a big truck. Don't sacrifice God's temple because you've got an issue with, right? Well, What is it about guys in this, eh? I mean, just... This does not get circulated beyond the confines of the truth. Well, it's a good job I've already resigned from Regent, otherwise I'd be... So, and far from being slaves working in the fields to provide food for the gods, it's a gift for us. The fullness of the earth is his glory. It's incredible flourishing. And we're not slaves. We're made in his image, every single one of us, regardless of our race, our status, or our gender. Every single one of us designed to be indwelt by the very living presence of God, to be his physical manifestation upon the earth. I mean, you let that loose and you cannot have ancient cities, because there are all these hierarchies with all these, you know, statements about status, right? And the gospel just comes and sweeps that all away. We'll talk about that in tonight's session in a bit more detail. And, you know, of course, our God doesn't actually need a temple. Creation is his temple. He doesn't need cities. No, doesn't need them. In fact, we built them because of our rebellion, but God will even take that up and use it for his glory. Amazing God that we have. He gets angry, however, when our cities end up killing the people they're meant to design to house. And you can see that, right? The rebuke of the prophets against the great cities of the ancient world built on the lives of the little people at the bottom. It's God's anger toward empires that do that. God doesn't need food. We don't need to feed him. Right? What we do is we bring the best stuff in and have a barbecue together, and most of it we get to eat. Right? That's a wonderful image of worship, right? It's a different kind of thing. What intriguing thing about this, I don't know if I'll get to it, so I'll say it now. The Romans were driven nuts by the Christians for all kinds of reasons. But in the Roman world, relating to the gods was all contractual. It was all legal. And you know, any lawyers among us, you really have to get the document written word perfect, don't you? One word out of place and the contract is void. Right? So in the Roman world, that's why all the prayers were perfectly laid out. They had to be recited by people who knew what they were doing, because it all had to be done in that particular precise order. Get something wrong and the deal's off. So the Romans were very keen about that when it came to their battles, right? They consult the gods, they consult the auspices, the prayers had to be offered properly, and only then would you go into battle. There's a famous story where some guy's off fighting a war and a rumour spread around Rome that he didn't do the auspices properly. There was a word that was wrong and he had to stop everything and come back to Rome and go through that and do it again, right? But the Christians, what were they doing? Well, they're just all going for it. And the Romans just driven nuts by this, right? These are people importuning God with any language they want to, and they're all doing it all at once. The Romans are going, how can you do that? Because right? That's how, now, let me ask you, your church, what does it look more like, the Romans or the early Christians? Where do you think the concern for absolutely precise liturgy comes from? Where do you think the concern for absolutely precise liturgy comes from? Now, I know it's important if you're repeating stuff, you want to, you know, it's good to have good theology. But, you know, it's interesting, some of the roots of that stuff. What does it say about the character of God? And so let me ask you, if you're asked to pray publicly, are you free just to kind of let what's on your heart come out, or are you worried about how it's going to sound in front of other people? I teach at a fairly well-known theological school. I know how scary it is to pray amongst my colleagues. Right? You constantly tick, cross, 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 tick, red line, and just Anyway, I know it with students at Regent, right? They're often terrified to pray publicly. And you think, where did that come from? What have we done that has become this kind of thing? Well, no. Our God's not like this. He wants to hear from his kids. Right? And the early Christians got that and they took full advantage. They just talked to Dad. Right? Because their relationship with Dad was based on love. It wasn't a legal contract. They'd been shown grace and they had freedom to come and talk to him. Right? So I'm going to just give you a little word. Don't try and be pious before God, okay? Just throw that stuff out. It's an insult to him because he knows you're not. Right? Right? So no airs and graces. Be what you are and just talk to him. Honor God by doing that, okay? That's to honor him. How do you know that you've got a good friendship? You know you've got a great friendship. You don't have to put any pretense on. You can just say exactly what you're thinking. You've got that relationship, right? So think about how we talk to God and ask yourself, do we in fact have a friendly relationship with him? Okay. Well, speaking then of us, God in fact cared a great deal for who we were. He wasn't concerned about maintaining the status quo. That was the problem. What he wanted was righteousness. He actually cared about that. And that's what transformed the notion of justice. Justice was no longer maintaining the status quo. Now it was about treating everyone with the love and mercy and compassion God had shown to us. Everyone. Right? The widow, the orphan, the fatherless, the sojourner in the land, even the Egyptian who oppressed you. That's what we do. So unlike these other nations, the God of Israel was very, very clear about what he expected of us. So we don't have that fear. We don't have that uncertainty. We know, right? Beautiful. Okay? Now, all of this is remarkable. The final point is that the God that we worship is not human. Unlike those other gods, which are just very large humans, he's different. He's always faithful. His mercy is new every morning. Incredible compassion. Right? Now, you see, if you've come at this thing, we're going to talk about this in just a bit, like an Athenian, where everything is about logic, right, and nothing can ever really change, you're going to end up with a view of a God who's like that. Right? And that's going to take you to call something called predestination, where everything's already laid out. You don't really have a choice. It's all been predetermined. Okay, and the most important thing is this God can never change his mind. He's got it all sorted, right? Then you're going to have a terrible time with what happens at the golden calf incident when God says, I'm going to judge Israel for their wickedness. And then Moses goes up and says, hang on, I've been watching you. Think about your reputation. And it says, and God relented. And that throws certain kinds of theologians into all kinds of conniption fits. And I would argue the reason it does that is because they're fundamentally Hellenist at that point. Because our God loves to change his mind, especially when we repent. He loves to do that. That's the great thing about our God, right? Yep, if we insist on treating people badly, he will judge us. But if you repent, he delights to change his mind. That's his character. He's a God who loves to show mercy. Mercy makes no sense in a world that's predestined. Makes no sense. So you can probably hear a few little echoes there where I think certain kinds of theology owing far too much to Athens than they do to the God of the Bible. Okay, so that's a bit of a review. I know we went on for a bit of time there, but just, I know last night, Friday night, what planet is this guy on anyway? Get it. So you okay? Do you want to have a short stand-up now before we jump to the next section? Good. So, hands, here we go. Right, let's see if you can get it right this time. That's it. Lift those knees, Mother Brown. Lift those knees, Mother Brown. Yeah, there you go. Okay, good. I'll sit down. Thank you. Next time we're going to sing while we're doing that, okay? Well, last night I finished by talking about it wasn't just the ancient world, it was Hellenism. That was the next big step. So the big challenge to Israel's ideas or Israel's story comes through Alexander the Great. And we talked about what he was trying to do is also form one new humanity based on Athens' view of the world. So he would build model cities. He had his own canon of texts. He had his own pantheon of gods. And I suggested to you that the Greek translation of the Hebrew Bible was an act of cultural resistance. It was saying no to Alexander. It's another story. It's a very different God. And you know him in a different way from what you think you do. And, you know, in the Maccabean period, one of the most difficult times in Israel's history, you know some of those stories, right? People being fried alive in pans. Fathers who were caught teaching their children Torah burnt alive in cages in Jerusalem. Mothers found with circumcised boys have the baby hung around their neck and thrown over the walls to dash to their deaths on the rocks below. Right? Huge impact on Israel's history. This incredible clash with Alexander. So I wanted to suggest, actually, that it was out of this battle and then ultimately the gospel that the modern world emerged. I mentioned five areas. Anyone remember? What was the first one? Five ideas that really shaped the modern world. First of all, about the cosmos. Yep, the universe is gifted with change, right? It's not perfect. It's gifted with change. If that's true, the only way to know about it is by actually looking at what's going on. Our notion of dynamic cities, where all people are meant to be regarded as equal, where the body is not the enemy, it's not a prison, where compassion and caring for the weak really do matter, all of that comes from Jerusalem. So it might sound a bit outrageous to say this initially, but again, I think the 21st century is the most Christian the world has ever seen when you look at those five categories. There would be no Silicon Valley without Moses and Jesus. It just wouldn't be. It's a direct consequence of that. Okay, so let's explain how this happens. You probably have a question at the back of your mind. How come we're in such a mess? We're going to come to that on Sunday morning around communion. Always a great time to do it because we're remembering who Jesus is. And he really does stand at the center of all of this. But it's great. I'm kind of clicking there, aren't I? Oh, is it this thing? I think it's this thing. It is. It's this thing. Okay, you can just all talk quietly to your neighbours while I try and get this. No, wait. See what a PhD does? Makes you completely inept. Here we go. Thank you, sir. Here we go. And this goes on my nose, is that right? How's that? That's better. Ah, very good. Oh, baby. Okay. It's working, we're good. So what I'd like to talk about this morning are the first two areas, cosmology, how we view the universe, and epistemology, how we think we know. Now, I'm using those two Greek terms to undermine them, but I'll just use them to start off with. Okay. Well, before we begin, it's really important to recognize that Athens did come up with an amazing idea. We really have to give them their due, because for the first time in human history, we meet this singularly brilliant idea, an astonishing act of imagination actually, that everything in the cosmos could be explained on the basis of intellect, simply the resources of the mind alone, via some kind of geometric, mathematically necessary logic. And some of you have experienced that. You know, you end up with QED at the end, this, therefore, right? That's kind of Athens' great contribution. And you have to admit, it's utterly remarkable that they came up with this. And behind it lay the glorious assumption that the universe itself was logical, which meant, actually, it confirmed or conformed to our view of what was reasonable. That's what they meant when they said the universe is logical, right? What's in here mirrors the universe, and so we can understand the universe by what's in here. Right? Now, why did they think that? Well, I suspect it's because, as you would know, it's an amazing thing to have a big idea, isn't it? Anyone had an interesting idea? Isn't it exciting? Got some new thought, you start to develop it. It's kind of like intellectual heroin, isn't it? For those of you who've had that stuff, right? I'm just not speaking from experience here, but okay. So you can see this whole thing of the adventure of ideas is incredibly attractive, and you understand why it's had such an impact on the West, because it really is seductive stuff. The problem is, it's wrong. It's simply wrong. Wherever you contest it, it's wrong. Now, we're not denying that reason has a role in understanding the world. But it always has to be based on what you see, and then it has to be tested against what you see. Right? You know that. Okay? So Athens starts with this idea that's mistaken, and guess what's going to happen? Well, start in the wrong place. So we come first to the cosmos. So the great, wonderful, imaginative idea, everything conforms to our logic. They look at the cosmos, And they're always dazzled by the stars. There's a wonderful story that Thales tells, or Plato tells about Thales, one of the earliest Greek thinkers, who apparently fell into a well once precisely because he was looking up the stars and didn't watch where he was going and tumbled over. And they called this the cosmos, and cosmos means what? Your wives probably put it on their faces a lot, right? We get the word cosmetic from cosmos. It's a thing of beauty. So they're actually really just, they're astonished by the beauty. Now, a couple of years ago, I was on a race from Victoria in British Columbia to Maui on a 50-foot Hunter. It was an amazing experience. Anyone know sailing? This is a tripod Hunter. They're pretty rare. It had two big water tanks along the side. You could fill it with 10,000 pounds of water. This thing was hugely powered. My goodness, it could fly. And, you know, we were out, I think, about 400 miles off the coast one night. And it was a fairly calm night, and I was on watch, and I just dazzled by the beauty of the stars, just which we miss mostly because we have so much light pollution. But if you've been out under it, it's absolutely gobsmacking. And they live in a world where they don't have that same kind of problem. So they're dazzled by this. They're gripped by it. And that they often thought about beauty. And let's be honest, right? You said this was a vision of heaven. Was that right? Kind of someone... I hope not. I hope there's women there. Because you guys look okay, but you're not really in the race, to be honest. Sorry, you know. Right? Right? Good. Come on, tell the truth. This is truth-telling. And God made it, and it's wonderful. Right? And you know that. You see these sensible blokes like us just completely go to butter in the presence of this gorgeous thing, right? Right? Yeah, you know about that. Right? If you don't, are you alive? We need to see if you've got a heartbeat here or something. And they knew that. They knew the incredible potency of beauty. And you've all experienced that. You know, you look across, say, the Grand Canyon, or you look at a sunset, or you visit, you know, the Rockies, and it's, you're just overwhelmed by the beauty of this. And how do you speak about it? Almost impossible. Okay? And that's one of the problems we have with the way we do theology. Because the way we do theology really has no way of handling beauty. Right? Because it will become abstract. How do you do the beauty stuff? Well, we try with poetry. Right, Brian? Right? One way to get at it, through metaphor. Okay? The Bible is much more concerned with metaphor than it is with the kind of precise definition that characterizes most of our theology. Right? So welcome to the difference between a worship service, right, and just the incredible passion that we can feel in environments where we're confronted by beauty. Something's gone wrong, it seems to me. So, amazing beauty of the cosmos up here, particularly in contrast to the brokenness of the world around them. They don't have medicine. So just about everyone you meet has some kind of, you know, either a scar, maybe got a damaged eye, right? And people who do archaeology of medicine will tell you that. Most people in the ancient world were disfigured in some way just because of the brokenness. You can understand that, you know, who wants to be a part of this when I can be a part of that? So as they think about beauty, and it's unchanging up there, there's a guy called Parmenides. He's the cheese you put on your pizza, right? Not really. He laid down that if something's true, it cannot change. And if you stop and think about it, that stands to reason, right? Now, if it's true, it's got to always be true. And if it changes, it's not true, right? Think about mathematics. 2 + 2 must always equal 4. If it doesn't, then you've got a problem. So they said, okay, if it changes, it's not true, and if it's not true, it's not real. That's the way they basically came at their cosmos. Now, that created an incredible problem for them, because the stars are not moving. They saw the wandering planets, but they saw those as below the lunar level, so that was part of the changeful stuff. How do you explain change? And there's a chap called Empedocles, apparently the disciple of Parmenides, who argued that what they saw as change was actually due to rotation. It looked like change, but it was the same thing just coming around over and over again. Right? And they just kept expanding the circle to try and accommodate all the apparent change. And you end up with this guy called Chrysippus. Now, I can understand why you're thinking, what's this got to do with the football? But this is really important stuff, folks. This is your cultural history. And if you don't know where this comes from, you're going to be a victim of the world rather than understanding it. Okay? So thanks for hanging in there. Chrysippus talked about, well, actually what the universe goes through, the whole universe goes through a cycle. He speaks of the restoration of the universe, which takes place not once, but over and over again to all eternity without end. Those of the gods who are not subject to this destruction, so quite a few are, but some gods manage to make it through this, having observed the course of one big period, know from this everything that's going to happen in all subsequent periods. He says, there will never be any new thing other than that which has been before, but everything is repeated down to the minutest detail. That's where pure reason takes you. Okay. Now, Epicureans don't quite fit that. These are Stoics I'm talking about. Remember on Mars Hill, two groups, Stoics and Epicureans? Epicureans are in the minority. They also believe the world is unchanging, but they think it's unchanging chaos. But both of them are different forms of the same meaninglessness. It's either all chaos and it just doesn't matter, or it's always repeated and it still doesn't matter. There's nothing you can do about it. So you know that dreadful coffee you had the other day? You've already had that untold millions of times before, and you will have it again. In fact, you've even heard this lecture. So if I was a true Platonist, I would simply be reminding you of what your soul already knew, kind of from all eternity, if that's what I believed, which I don't. So what was the material world? It was just rotation, but because it was full of change, itself wasn't real. It was merely appearance, right? Wasn't truly real. And that's why the Greeks love philosophy. We'll talk about that. If that's how you see the cosmos, guess how you're going to think about it. Right? Now, one of the key ideas in this Greek world is that everything is material, including souls and the gods. Right? They just happen to be finer matter. And you know in the Greek world, you've got four kinds of stuff. Anyone know what they are? Earth, water, fire and wind. Great, okay. So some of that stuff goes up, which is what? Fire in the air. And what comes down? Earth and wind, right? So when they say that the earth is the center of the universe, you understand that is not a compliment. That's saying the earth is the grease trap of the cosmos. That's where all the crud goes. It goes into the center, all the really good stuff goes up, and that's what Socrates is into, right? Don't weep for me, Argentina. I'm about to leave this place. I'm about to enter into this eternity. So twinkle, twinkle, little Socrates, how we wonder what you are, right? And you want to know where the Christian's notion of going to heaven comes from? It's not from reading your Bible. It's from listening to that bloke, actually. Right? And the idea of leaving your body behind, we'll talk about that, and your soul being saved, that is fundamentally pagan, the way many of us talk about it. Right? That comes from their worldview, not biblical. Right? Now, when they do this, they basically create an upstairs-downstairs universe. So the perfect region is beyond the moon, where nothing ever really changes, and below it is the cruddy stuff. Now, you hold that view, you're never going to learn about astronomy. And it wasn't until that was broken down in the 16th century and 15th century that people began to open their eyes to the possibility that actually the stars are made of the same stuff as we are. A guy called Nicholas of Cusa. And, of course, you had the great, you remember that, supernova. Shocked everybody because suddenly the heavens changed. That was never meant to be possible. That's why some people didn't like Galileo, because when you looked at the telescope, through the telescope at his moon, the moon wasn't perfect, it was pockmarked. And you could see little planets, little things moving around Jupiter, right? And that just totally threw people's worlds into confusion. This stuff can't happen. Now you see, if you tied your theology to Aristotle and Plato, you're in serious deep smelly stuff. Because you've actually bought into a way of knowing the world that is fundamentally mistaken. And when people start realizing it's mistaken, down goes your theological ship, right, with that failed worldview. So if you get to know me, I really do not want anything to do with Aristotle or Plato in Christianity. And I'll tell you why a bit later on, but you've probably got some idea from here. So how are we doing? A few more minutes, okay. So, if this is the cosmos, right, it's all about what doesn't change. So for the Greeks, change is the enemy because it's not real, can't be true, right? So it's either cyclical, well, it's all cyclical, and it never changes. Imagine living in a world like that. Would you ever have movements for social reform in a world like that? No. And furthermore, if you're going to be a logical person, what do you want? You want the status quo. Changing the status quo is the one thing you can't do if you're going to be a logical person. Now, you can tell how many Christians buy into that by just asking the question, how much does the status quo and the tradition matter, and how much does actually life and growth and development matter? Right? You have a conversation with someone and you weigh it in those two terms, and I can tell you if they're Christian or Platonist. If they're Christian or Hellenist, right? I can tell you. So you think this stuff's not important? If you're not aware of this stuff, folks, it will come around and bite you in some very tender places repeatedly. Right? So how do you know a world like this? Well, it's all going to be a matter of perfect ideas. That's how the thing's going to work here. There's the little alarm telling me it's time to finish, and I shall in just a moment. So the Greeks actually knew about observation. Homer talks about a guy called a histor. Does that sound like a word we know? Histor? History, absolutely. And he could resolve disputes because he was there and he saw them, right? Or he was there and he heard. But the more emphasis the philosophers put on, now it's all about ideas, the less attention they were giving to the histor. Why? Plato tells you. He has a book called The Phaedo, and he has this to say. When the soul, which is that perfect or, you know, fine material part of you that you're hoping one day will leave your body and wing its way up to join Socrates, twinkle, twinkle, right? Whenever the soul makes use of the body for any investigation, either through seeing or hearing or any of the other senses, it is dragged by the body to things which never remain the same. And it strays and is confused and becomes dizzy like a drunken man. You can understand why Plato never gave rise to science. Right? Galen, the so-called father of anatomy, he originally toyed with what we call experiment and gave it up because it wasn't logical. And you can see why. Why would you think you could learn from the stuff that changes? You never do that. Aristotle was a bit more concerned with observation. But even here, what matters is what seemed reasonable. And you know, you meet this all the time, folks, and we fall for it. Someone comes up with a reasonable explanation and immediately we're seduced. What you ought to be asking is, where's the evidence? Always, where's the evidence? And the fact that we kind of get seduced by the, oh, that's a reasonable explanation, we're still influenced by this guy. Well, because it's a bit late in the morning, you're probably having trouble staying awake, I should share this illustration with you. And it's also one of Aristotle's favourites. So here it is. May I stand on here for a second? Right, so you can actually... It's all right, I'll leave my trousers on. But why do men have bits that hang down? That's Aristotle's big question. And he has an explanation. And the answer is loom weights. Loom weights. You're all looking puzzled. You're an uneducated bunch. Haven't you been... Haven't you gone to Athens, any of you? Haven't you studied there? Oh, my goodness, what a mess we're in. Well, see, for the Greeks, as they think about stuff, it's coming up with a reasonable explanation, and they often use analogy, which is what all of us use. The first thing we do when we encounter something is try and make it fit into what we know. That's one of the things that just damages the gospel so often, right? I think being Christian is about becoming a good Australian. No. I have to become a good child of Abraham. Becoming a Christian is not about becoming a good American. It's about becoming a child of Abraham. And get that wrong, and the gospel's going to suffer. Becoming a Christian is not about becoming a good Chinese. It's about becoming a child of Abraham. Right? We're all called to that. Right? Now, that's shocking and hard for many of us to understand, but that's what we're called to. Aristotle. Analogy, trying to make sense of stuff, right? So he's looking around, sitting in his house. Where are things I can see that hang down? And I spy with my little eye in the corner is a loom. Every house has them. And, you know, archaeologists will tell you that you'll find evidence of this stuff all over the place in the ancient world. In order to lay down the wefts properly, you've got to have very tight warps, right? They're the vertical lines. How do you keep them tight? With loom weights, right? Right? And that's why men are great and women aren't. Women don't have loom weights. Right? So it perfect sense, right? Perfect sense, right? This stuff that hangs down is what keeps the male body trim, taut, and terrific. Well, it does with me because I'm, you know, this. But some of you, well, you know. It's okay. It's all right. Come on, you've got to laugh, right? You have to laugh. God must have a sense of humor. I mean, seriously, a sense of humor. Well, now you. Yeah, I actually cycle in my Lycra. Now, you know, you might be tempted to ask, well, doesn't this have something to do with semen? And it never occurred to the Greeks to ask that question. Why would it? Because they had a perfectly logical explanation. Can you get in the force of this? I mean, it's hard for us to get used to because we've been so impacted by the gospel. And we've been so shaped by science, we're always going back to, well, is that really the case? But you've got to get rid of that. If it seemed reasonable, that was it. It was done, right? Now, if you asked them, they probably would have said, oh, no, it's got nothing to do with that stuff, right? And we all know where semen comes from, right? Okay, well, what is it? It's frothy, isn't it? And we know where all the frothy stuff goes. Goes up to the head, right? All the frothy stuff goes up. Whence arose the saying, boy, he's a real something head. No, they didn't say that. That was my invention. You can think about that a bit later on. And okay. And then they'd say, remember all those split heads on the battlefield with the frothy stuff when the, you know, cranium's cracked open? Well, that just demonstrates it. And then furthermore, look at a newborn baby. It's a perfect replica of a human being. So that means that semen comes from every part of the human body, collects in the head. And then they knew about the normal delivery system and all that. But perfectly wonderful explanation. It's got its own logic. You have to admire that. It's very persuasive. It's just entirely wrong. Can you see that? You know, that's why I'm just dead set keen on teaching people to read the Bible well. Because what seems reasonable to us can be so seductive, we don't actually read the text. We read what we know is true into it. And when we do that, we blunt its transforming power. Right? And it's a scary thing to actually leave yourself at the mercy of the text. Are you prepared to follow wherever it goes? Right? That's the one decision. I say that to my students. Anyone in the classroom who's got it all together and has their theology perfectly sorted out? Anyone here? Right? Got it all sorted? Okay. No one? Okay, that means at some point your theology is wrong or deficient. Oh, not quite sure about that. Okay. So I'll say to them, I have a question for you. Are you actually going to be a true Christian, or is being a Baptist going to matter to you more than following Jesus? Or a Pentecostal, or an Anglican, or a member of PBC? Right? I mean, how serious are you about this Jesus thing? How Hellenistic are you going to be, right? You're going to hang on to the ideas of we think what should be the case, or are we going to pursue this text come hell or high water? Because we can go to no one else. Only you have the words of eternal life. That's what we're singing about, right? He's the only one who can resurrect us from the dead. No one else can do that. Not even Apple. Though they might need it themselves, right? A little while. Okay. And I'm an Apple fan. Sorry, shouldn't go down that road. Ooh, right. Now, here's the, you know, we talked about this last night. Heavier objects fall faster than light ones. Remember that? It took 800 years before somebody actually dropped them. And the takeaway from this is, sorry, not to laugh. And I know why we laugh. I'm not knocking us for laughing. That's not the takeaway. Aristotle was an intellectual giant. The takeaway is to realize how seductive human reason can be, even while being hopelessly mistaken. Right? That even people of Aristotle's caliber can make really dumb statements because he's seduced by the intellectual beauty of a reasonable argument. It's incredible deceptive power. That shows, explains why Athens was really good at demonstrating stuff like geometry and so hopeless at science. It really drives me nuts when people talk about Greek science. It's not science, not as we know it. It pretends to be science because it looks at stuff for half a second, and then once it's got its logical idea, it never tests it. That's not science. Call it whatever you like, and I think that's why Islam is still locked in the ancient world. Because they got Aristotle and Plato through these Christian Coptic monks or whoever, right? And they've never moved beyond it. Right? And we did. We'll talk about that. I have a wonderful little book by John Glassy called A Man of Misconceptions. And the front cover is actually printed upside down. Initially, I thought it was a mistake, then I realized it was a bit of a laugh. But it's about this guy, 17th century Aristotelian called Athanasius Kircher. You heard of him? He probably wrote more stuff on a range of topics about the world than any other individual. And because he's Aristotelian, it's all basically useless. Because it's all based on what seems like a good idea to him without testing it. A man of misconceptions. That's why Steven Weinberg, in his book, To Explain the World, The Discovery of Modern Science, concludes, Greek philosophy more hindered than helped. And it wasn't until the West rejected Plato and Aristotle they were actually free to look at the world and see it for what it was instead of what we thought it should be. Arthur Koestler's book, The Sleepwalkers, exactly the same thing. People not seeing. All right, now it's probably time for me to finish, would we say? Time to have coffee break now. And maybe I'll come and pick this up tonight. We'll go on a bit further. I know we haven't got to the Jerusalem bit, but we'll come back to Jerusalem cosmology and Jerusalem's response to this in this evening session. And now you are free, oh desperate ones, to have your coffee and escape. Okay? Bless you.
Thanks, Rick.